Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Mary DeMuth grew up filled with fear. As a small child, she was repeatedly raped, abused, and threatened by the older boys at her babysitter's home. Her unstable home environment, filled with parties, drugs, and a neglectful mother, served to heighten her feelings of insecurity. At 10, her biological father died, and Mary became extremely afraid of death. By the time she reached high school, she wanted to take her life. But God had other plans for Mary. She was invited to a Young Life retreat and gave her life to Christ. Today, she walks free from the fears that once shackled her. Mary is a popular author, speaker, and blogger. You can find her at marydemuth.com. Her ebook, Live Uncaged, is free when you subscribe to her newsletter. Mary, welcome to Heartline.
Great to be here.
Mary, you grew up in a very unstable home. How did that affect you?
So much insecurity, and there was so much of a part of me that was longing to be loved, and I'm just so thankful that I met Jesus when I did, because I think I would have been one of those people that looked for love in all the wrong places.
Can you describe your home life and how it added to those feelings of insecurity?
Yeah, I definitely had a lot of instability, and when I was really young, my mom and one of my stepfathers was pretty interested in the drug culture, and we were growing little plants in a closet that they would sell, and they would have really wild parties. And when they had those parties, sometimes people would get so stoned that they would try to pass a joint to me. And
wow.
That whole time in my life, I was always scared. We lived in a neighborhood, and I was getting things stolen from me all the time. And also during that year, after kindergarten, I would go to babysitters, and during that time, these boys would come to take me out to play. They were teenage boys, and as a five-year-old, I thought, you know, why did the babysitter let them take me? But they did, and they spent that year molesting me in different parts of the neighborhood and in the woods and things like that. And so that was the beginning of my life. So the first couple of years were full of chaos and disorder and rape and really not feeling protected. And so, of course, all of those factors led to an extreme need for love and an extreme need for stability, and I just didn't have it. I tried to create it myself as a five-year-old, which wasn't very successful, unfortunately.
So all these parties are going on. Your mom is just checked out, basically. I mean, how was she?
Yeah, and that's kind of how I've had to view it, that she just wasn't available because of her addiction at that time.
And so you just sat there by yourself as a little kid while everybody was just partying and carrying on and nobody attended to you.
Right. I did have a father at that time. My biological father was around my life during that time of my life, but he would come and pick me up every other weekend. And he did pay attention to me, and I had some grandparents who also were keeping an eye out for me. But in the day-to-day life of me, there really wasn't. And I was an only child, so there wasn't like a sister or a brother that I could go to or they could come to me. I was pretty much alone.
So what were the messages you received about yourself as a result of your mother's neglect? Because, I mean, all kids get messages about, you know, how parents are emotionally attuned or available to them. We come into the world asking several questions. Am I loved? Am I valued? And is my attachment figure sufficiently near and responsive and attuned to me? And obviously that wasn't the case for you. So what kind of messages were you getting about yourself?
The message I got was I was in the way, I wasn't wanted, and I was an inconvenience, and that she wished that she hadn't had me. Hmm. And that has been confirmed, that's been confirmed later in my life with some other conversations I've had, which is, you know, painful to admit and difficult to reconcile, but especially now as a mom when I adore my children and I just don't get it. I totally don't get it. But yeah, the messages were, you know, please stay out of my way. Another message was, don't ever emote. Don't be sad because it makes me upset. So I was not to be upset about anything, which is why I never told my mom about the rape at the time, because two reasons. One, I finally told my babysitter after about 7 months of it going on, and she told me that she would tell my mom, and of course she was a liar, so she didn't, but I thought she had. So in my mind, I thought, my mom knows about this and doesn't care. And so that was another message of, if anyone is going to protect Mary, it will be Mary. It's not going to be any adult. It's not going to be anybody. It'll only be me.
Wow. How did you handle your emotions? Did you just learn to stuff things then?
Yeah, I was not allowed to have them, so I just chose not to have them. But, you know, of course, that came out in a violent torrent after I became a Christian. It was interesting. They've been stuffed for all those years, and then when I met Jesus, they all came out in this just crazy amounts of emotion. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, there were some great people around me at the time that prayed me through that.
So the babysitter was kind of, she wasn't very good. She wasn't a good person.
No, definitely evil. And, you know, she just didn't want to be bothered. So if she could babysit kids that would be taken away by other kids, then that meant she didn't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. And all the better. And then, of course, when a child finally tells her what's going on, even though she should have known, of course she knew, and not doing anything about it, obviously that's evil.
So, I mean, these are kids are sexually abusing you. Were you terrified? What was going on in your little heart at that time?
There was a lot of detachment from it because I was only five and I couldn't process it.
Right.
So I just kind of flew into the sky in a sense. I would look above me and try to escape it. But yes, terror was huge because they would threaten me with, if I told anyone, they would kill my mom or they would kill my dad. I thought that they knew how to kill people.
Mm.
And so for me to tell was a big deal. I was risking people's lives by telling, but I could not take it anymore, especially when they brought their friends. And once they brought their friends, that's when I got brave enough to tell.
You said you pretended to be asleep to avoid.
Well, finally, after I told my babysitter, and then, you know, the next day the boys came again, and the next day they came again, I realized that I thought my mom knows and she doesn't care. So the only thing I could do to save myself was to get home from kindergarten, eat a quick lunch, and sleep for 4 or 5 hours on my babysitter's bed. And that was the only way, because she just couldn't be inconvenienced. And so if I was just out of her hair and asleep, she wasn't going to go in there and wake me up. That was too much work. So that was the only way I could save myself for the rest of the school year.
You said you were filled with guilt and shame. How did that affect you later in life?
I think the shame, it was more shame than guilt. I actually received a gift during that time when I was being violated like that. I knew it was not my fault, and that's a very rare gift. Most people believe it's their fault or
Absolutely.
They did something to deserve it. Yeah, and so I really believed that they were monsters and they were doing something terrible and it wasn't my fault. But the shame of it, of all of that was huge, of just knowing that I'm only useful to be used. And that, you know, I'm sure that that's stuck with me throughout my whole life. I've been healed a significant amount, but there's still that little thread in there, I think, that I'm still battling.
Do you think that affects people, women especially, with, you know, sex, intimacy, and relationship and marriage?
Absolutely. And my husband and I wrote an article for Curia, which is Christianity Today's women's magazine online.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about how the marriage bed can be a place of healing for sexual abuse victims. Yeah, absolutely. Because as one who's been victimized, I can feel victimized very easily. And a lot, the statistics bear out that a lot of women or men who are sexually abused either abstain from sex because it just brings up too much stuff, or they divorce because they can't handle it anymore, or, you know, or they work through it. And we've learned to work through it by God's amazing grace. And, you know, his part of the article was very telling, because he had to, you know, he was frustrated and angry, and not at me, but at what had happened to me, and had to be so very sensitive to triggers and all those other things that sexual abuse victims walk through.
Absolutely. What a much needed topic to address. That's awesome that y'all did that. And you, it takes a special kind of man, to be able to be sensitive to that and not personalize it.
Right. And, you know, we're not perfect. So he did personalize it, and I personalized it. And we've, you know, walked through
the valley
of the shadow.
Yeah.
We did work through it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't easy.
No.
Of course, he took it personally.
Yeah, but then, you know, the cool thing is you work through it, and you can now know the triggers, know the things that, you know, come up, and hopefully, you know, have the scales tip a little bit, you know? It's better
absolutely.
Than... Yeah, absolutely. Ever have any nightmares or flashbacks as a result of the abuse, even like today?
Not today, no. I did growing up, and I did all the way in through college, but yeah, those have really faded. That was a really long time ago, and God's done some significant healing. So no, I haven't had them lately.
So getting past the shame, you know, that can, the beliefs attached to that shame can build strongholds in our lives and cause us to deny, avoid, control, whatever. Obviously, Christ was an integral part of that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a highly sexualized environment, especially in my father's care. And so there was some very strange messages that were, you know, kind of spoken over me, or at least lived over me. And it was a creepy message that girls are really only meant for sexual pleasure. And in light of that, you know, there is a shame in, you know, attached to that. And I've just learned to, I mean, really honestly, just to give it to Jesus and say, please wash me of this, you know. And I even struggle with, you know, day to day is thinking the worthlessness of me. I know that's not true. I know that Jesus has died for me, and I just have to continually remind myself of that.
Right, so refuting those lies of the enemy and replacing that with the truth of who you are in Christ. And
Yes, those simple truths that we know we need to do that we don't always do, but it's important to do because it works.
Yeah, absolutely, when we do it. We have to be intentional and deliberate about doing it, though, because if not, we'll get sucked down that vortex of negative, self-defeating thinking.
Yes, and it is a vortex, and it goes deeper and deeper.
Did you ever get counseling to get work through a lot of this stuff?
Initially, no. When I first told my mom what had happened, I was 15 years old. It was after I had come to Christ, and she wanted to send me to a secular counselor, and even then I just knew that wasn't going to be what I needed. So I avoided it for a while, and then I spent several years in college where people just prayed for me, and I fell apart all the time, and then God just used all that time to heal me. But when I reached my 30s and my children were reaching the ages of how old I was when the abuse happened, that's when I started to explore counseling. I did a lot of, you know, I read The Wounded Heart and by Dan Allender, and went through the workbook. I did a lot of prayer counseling with people who were very wise, and then eventually did a several years, about 3 years of counseling as a result of all that.
You said in your book, Living Uncaged, that sometimes we're too concerned about what others think of us and that it causes us to hide or wear masks to protect ourselves from others' rejection. Was that true for you? And if so, how did that hinder your personal growth and freedom?
You know, the weird thing is, and I think this is just how God has composed me and made me, I have always, for the most part, since I've been a Christian, I have always been so myself. And I haven't, even though rejection comes, and that's part of life, I have never felt the need personally to be somebody other than who I am. And I think that's just part of the way God has made me. There's, you know, I just don't want to hide. I think because I grew up in a home where there were secrets and hiding and no one ever told the truth about anything, that I can't stand it. So mm-hmm. I have to live in light of the truth.
Well, it's powerful that you did. Look at the result of the work you've done because you chose not to. Do you think a lot of people do that?
Yeah, I mean, I've even had relationships where you would think that everything was hunky-dory, and I've tried to probe beneath the surface of my friend and poke around, and then only to find out that there's some terrible thing that's been going on for several years. It's more of a sin, so that, of course, there's shame associated with it. But I did not know, and that frustrates me, because in my mind I'm thinking, why don't you just tell me who you are so I can love you? But, you know, that doesn't always happen. People are so afraid to be found out. And that's the lie of the enemy. He wants to keep us in isolation. And the longer we keep in isolation, the longer we keep the lies. And we don't realize how much freedom there is once we tell the lies. And once we say, we come true, you know, with the truth and say what's really going on in our lives.
Absolutely right. It's those fears that keep us in bondage. Were you able to forgive your perpetrators?
Yes, I was. And mainly because I don't even remember what they look like. I mean, I know that they were older than me, but and I think I have their names now. I've tried to figure out who they are because I'm kind of weird that way. But yes, I was able to forgive, and I'm more in that place of feeling deeply sorry for them and praying that God somehow intersects their lives so that they will not be in bondage to what they have done for the rest of their lives. Now, the fact is that they were most likely perpetrated against, because most perpetrators have been perpetrated against. And so I'm praying that they would break the cycle and that they would not be haunted by what they've done.
Did it take you a while to get there, though, Mary? I mean,
of course.
Yeah.
Of course, yes, years and years. And okay. Forgiveness doesn't happen in a moment. And I didn't even address those issues when I first came to Christ. They started popping up in college. And there's a lot of times where I've just had to say, I choose to forgive. I make that choice, and I don't feel it. I don't want to, and I don't like it, but I choose to. And then, you know, 4 minutes later, I might not feel very forgiving, and I just whispered again, I choose to forgive. I just choose.
Was it hard for you to trust other people after being let down and abused by so many people?
Yeah, it was. But there were, I think the problem with me was that there was such a gaping hole in my heart that superseded my trust, my trust-o-meter. And so I would still open myself up to be abused again because I so desperately needed the love.
Hmm.
I'm much wiser now, and I have a lot more discernment. But, of course, when you're young, you don't necessarily have that discernment going.
Yeah. How did you come to Christ?
I had come to the end of my rope as an eighth grader and a ninth grader, where I was writing suicide poetry and wanting to end my life. I was sent to a counselor in junior high, you know, one of the counselors in junior high, and he basically gave me a hall pass to get out of any class that I ever needed to. I was a straight-A student, so I didn't abuse that at all, but I would burst into tears in the middle of class, and he let me come in. At that time, my mom was working through her third divorce, and that third father had become my real father, in a sense, because my real father had taken his life when I was 10. And so my whole world was falling apart. And, you know, everyone in junior high will never say that it was awesome anyway. So you've got junior high going on top of that. In ninth grade, I had a friend who started going to Young Life, and she invited me. It's a ministry to high school kids. And I started going, and it was crazy and fun, and we'd sing awesome songs and everything and shaving cream and whatever. But at the last 15 minutes, someone would talk about Jesus just for 15 minutes, and every time that person talked, I just knew I had found what I was looking for. And I just loved, I was soaking up the gospel. And by the time I was in 10th grade, I went to a weekend retreat where they really said the whole gospel, A to Z, and that's when I gave my heart to Jesus.
So during this time of junior high, your mom was still sort of a mess, it sounds like.
Just not there. She was completely absent. I had my stepfather was working until 10 o'clock at night, and she would scoot in at like 9:59. And so as a 7th and 8th grader, I would come home from school, I would take care of the farm, we lived on a farm, and I would cook my own dinner, and I was completely alone. And so I was just abandoned. I just didn't have I didn't have any parental support. And so you can imagine with all that alone time and all the things that had happened to me, what would go through my mind and how much worse it would get. But yes, there was not a good connection there.
How did your father's death impact you?
Extremely hard. He, at that point in my mind, had become my hero. He had become everything to me. And he was the one who loved me. And so when he died, you know, I died inside too, because the hero had died, you know. And then in retrospect, I've, you know, kind of learned that there was some chinks in that armor, and it was a little more problematic to mourn him. But yeah, it was terrible.
So you idealized him, maybe made that relationship more than it was, because at least it was something better than anything you had.
Yes, exactly. That's true.
Any of the stepfathers? You said the third stepfather was more your father. Any of the others you were close to or even took an interest in you?
Yeah, there was just two stepfathers. So there's my father, then a stepfather, then a stepfather. The second one, the first stepfather, was an awful man, very angry. And I've actually tried to find him, and I've written him a letter. He's never written me back. But he was a violent, angry, scary person. And so I was thankful, actually, when my mom divorced him. And then the third one was right after that, and he has been the most fatherly to me during those growing up years.
Fear was a big part of your life. How did you learn to overcome the fear? It's a spiritual battle at the end of the day. I get that, but is that still something you struggle with? I mean, startling, anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and in fact, my kids and husband all laugh about it. And because if I'm in a room and someone startles me, I just freak out. I'm very easily startled, and I don't know that it seems like it's so inbred in me that I will never get over that part. But if I let my mind go there, I can panic pretty easily. So I have learned to talk myself down. Mm-hmm. And but growing up, I was constantly panicked, constantly in a state of fight or flight. Always worried that if around the next corner someone was going to grab me or get me or take me or do something to me, because I simply was alone and I just didn't have anybody to take care of me.
Yeah,
so I was
you.
Constantly running. I was looking over my shoulder all the time. It was kind of like, you know, in a sense, I'm living in post-traumatic stress because of that long childhood of fear, you know, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Were you ever angry at God about what happened to you?
Oddly, no. And I don't say that to diminish anyone else that's been angry with God. I think that's totally common and normal. I think it's because the moment I met him, I found what I've been looking for my entire life. And I found the daddy who would never leave me. And even when I was working through and very upset about what had gone on in the past, there was something in me that knew somehow that God was going to use it for his good, for my good, for others' good. And, you know, I really can't explain that. I think it's kind of the same thing of knowing that the rape wasn't my fault. It was just a grace that God gave me.
What's awesome about your story is that there's this emerging theme of redemption. I think it's hard for people who are going through trials to see ahead, to realize that God can use the sad and difficult parts of their story for a bigger picture and purpose. Can you talk about how you were able to begin to think about reinvesting your life again after all the trauma you suffered?
Yeah, it's been a process, definitely. I have always had this desire, once I became a Christian, to impart Jesus to people. And, you know, even in high school, just a year or two after I had come to Christ, I was praying for people, sending little notes. Because I had been so abandoned in my life, I did not want the soul to feel that way. And I was going to, you know, be the savior of the world in a sense. I was going to save everybody. So that transition from being a victim to wanting to help others who are victims came pretty quickly. But the Lord really needed to walk me through the decade of my 20s and early 30s to get me to a healthy place where when I was ministering to people, it wasn't about me anymore, but it was about them. And there had to be some significant healing that had to take me through. And, you know, of course, I'm still on that journey now, but I'm still in a place where I have a passion for people and to see them set free. And I tell my story to go, oh, come feel sorry for me, this terrible story. It's It's more like, I'm going to tell you my story because God redeemed me and he can redeem you. Then the focus has changed from me needing catharsis to me longing for someone else to have catharsis.
What do women who've been abused need to know, Mary?
They need to know that the enemy of our souls came to steal, kill, and destroy, and I believe his greatest weapon is sexual abuse. And if you have experienced that, you have experienced the worst kind of spiritual warfare that can ever happen to a human soul. Therefore, you cannot diminish it. You cannot pretend it didn't happen. You cannot just put on a paste on a smiley face and pretend all is well. You have to get healed. You have to love your family enough to get healed. You know, we always think, oh, it's selfish for me to think about my own issues, but they come out in your behavior. They come out in the way you treat your spouse. They come out in your marriage bed. They come out in the way you treat your children. So if you cannot do it for your own sake, you must just heal for the sake of your children and your family. And to do that is to really run to Jesus and to really ask him what he wants for your healing plan. That can involve people praying for you. Certainly that was my story. It can involve getting counseling, part of my story. It can involve journaling, certainly part of my story. All sorts of ways God will use to heal you. He needs you to be willing, because he can't heal someone that's unwilling, who's putting their hand up and saying, don't touch that painful area in my heart. He needs to know that you are in this for the long haul, and he will can do some amazing things. But I think so many of us don't want to look back on those times. We want to sweep it under a rug.
Well, yeah.
I'm not saying that we should be enslaved to it and always be thinking about it, but that we would be open to letting his eyes rest on it.
Yeah, I think we think, I can't go to those places of emotional pain. It'll be too much. It'll overwhelm me. But what ends up happening is I'm living that pain out day in, day out, week in, week out, year in, year out. So I'm really not, you know, saving myself anything. Mary, thank you so much for just being with us today and telling your story. How can folks get a hold of you if they want to contact you?
They can go on my website, marydemuse.com. It's also called liveuncaged.com. I'll take you to the same place. Also, if they are interested, there's a free newsletter that comes every month called Live Uncaged, and you get a free book if you sign up, and that's also called Live Uncaged. And I think it'll be a blessing to your listeners.
Mm. Well, God bless you for the work you're doing, and may he continue to bless you.
Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks, Mary. God bless. Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.